You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 28, 2023. I'm Jessica Liu from Drake University. Here is our first story. It's Giving Tuesday. Area nonprofits ask for grassroots support from community. The largest day of giving in the region, Giving Tuesday, has returned. The annual event encourages people to celebrate generosity through donations. Share Iowa, an initiative in the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, connects do-gooders to area nonprofits. The one-stop online platform helps find easy ways of doing good through financial gifts, in-kind donations, or items or volunteerism. Share Iowa supports the work of more than 200 nonprofits in 9 countries: Cass, Fremont, Harrison, Mills, Moana, Montgomery, Page, Potawatomi, and Shelby. For all of us to give back to the nonprofit organizations who are doing wonderful necessary work in our communities during Giving Tuesday, 712 maximizes a natural and traditional season of giving. Donna Dostal, President and CEO of the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, said in a news release, "For nonprofits to end the year on this high note of support and financial strength really makes a difference in the impact they create." An image is shown of the Community Foundation for Western Iowa hosting an event and hosting an end-of-day celebration for Giving Tuesday 712 at Full-Fledged Brewing on Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. A similar community party is planned for today's Giving Tuesday 712. As in the years past, the foundation has earned $250,000 for a 20% match on charitable gifts to endowment funds operated through the foundations. The 20% match is on gifts up to $100,000 per fund. Endowment funds are designed to build and grow over time, which provides income to the nonprofit organizations for years to come. They are an investment into an organization's future sustainability so it may continue its work. If an organization has an endowment fund through the Community Foundation for Western Iowa, a donor will see a donate to endowment button as one of the giving options to support their favorite nonprofits. The Community Foundation for Western Iowa office will be the heart of Giving Tuesday 712 fun and entertainment this year. All day long, community members and nonprofits can visit the Community Foundation office at 536 E Broadway in Council Bluffs for check presentations, special guest appearances, and to be part of this excitement that giving creates throughout the day. The Community Foundation will also provide an array of $1,000 hourly prizes sponsored by area businesses and individuals for Share Iowa nonprofit organization that participate in Giving Tuesday 712. At the end of the day, everyone from across the region is encouraged to come to Community Foundation's office from 5 to 7 p.m. to celebrate the success and generosity of Giving Tuesday. We love to celebrate this day of giving and encourage the community, nonprofit organizations, and their supporters to celebrate with us, Dostal said in the release. We are thrilled to show what the West Coast of Iowa can do when we come together and support organizations that have a big impact on our community. New this year, Cadelman Steel Fabrication Incorporated will sponsor the activities throughout the day. We are honored to be involved with Share Iowa and the Community Foundation for Western Iowa as they create a culture of philanthropy in our area. Tony Hovina, president of the owner of Cadelman Steel, said in the release, "We are thankful for a community that has supported us for nearly 100 years. Cadelman Steel understands the importance of giving back to our community, and partnering as this year's Giving Tuesday 712 sponsor is a great way to make an impact in our area and give where we live." Donors are encouraged to visit sharegoodiowa.org to find new nonprofits to support on Giving Tuesday and any day throughout the year. On to our next article. Potawatomi County Rural Recycling Center marks 5 years in operation. 5 years ago, the Pottawatomie County Rural Recycling Center opened the doors of its new home off Highway 59, just north of Oakland. The goals for the new facility were to foster participation in recycling throughout the county and minimize waste to conserve energy, recover resources, and protect the environment. Over the last 5 years, rural Pottawatomie County residents have shown that they are up to the task. An image is shown of the now open sign for the Pottawatomie County Recycling Center. In 2022, the recycling center recycled 44,320 pounds of paper, 35,740 pounds of plastic, and 87,740 pounds of cardboard, according to the county. In total, the center processed more than 2.4 million pounds of recyclable products in 2022, up to 1.8 million in 2021 and 1.6 million in 2020. Matt Wyant, Director of Pottawatomie County Planning and Development, attributes the center's success to partnerships with city and local organizations throughout the county. What we've tried to do since day one in this facility is emphasize the importance of collaboration. Wyant said in the news release, "We are grateful for the assistance we've received from local organizations to help accomplish our goals, and we're excited about the participation from our residents that have helped ensure our county is thriving for future generations. Together, we've really made a difference." Prior to operations moving to the current location, rural recycling was managed out of a small and aging building near Hancock. The move to the new facility has allowed easier access for residents and expanded recycling services. "We've accepted a number of items at no cost to our residents," said Tom Grove, manager of the recycling center. "Paper, cardboard, plastics, glass, metal, and household hazardous waste like batteries and oils are all accepted free of charge. We'll take a few other items for a small fee, and we operate Tuesday through Saturday to meet the needs of our community the best we can." In addition to building the recycling facility, the county has also made an available portable recycling trailers at several parks and towns of Carson, Crescent, Hancock, Medina, McClelland, Oakland, and Walnut, with more to come. "We have goals to continue to expand our reach," Wyant said. "We'd like to add some additional trailers throughout the county in the future, and it's exciting to think about how we've grown and where we're headed." The county is also trying to help residents get rid of unwanted items that might still be in good enough condition to find another home. The swap shop is laid out like a thrift store, where people can browse through everything from furniture to electronics to bikes. Residents can drop off their own unwanted but still useful goods or take home whatever they'd like at no cost. "It's been a very stressful venture for us," Grobe said, "but many residents have benefited from that program, and it's a great way for us to promote responsible disposal of unwanted items." The Pottawatomie County Rural Recycling Center is located at 41911 Industrial Drive, north of Oakland. The center is open Tuesday through Saturday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. The next headline reads, "Iowa Public Universities Handle Increased Need from Students Facing Food Insecurities." A half hour before Iowa State University's food pantry was ready to open, a small group of students had already gathered outside, ready to pick up groceries and other necessities. Doctoral candidate Mobina Amaharali worked on her laptop in the hallway. She was hoping to get tofu and canned goods from the shop as a supplement to the groceries she buys. Frederick Osi, also a doctoral candidate, wanted to grab protein and spaghetti if he could. Shop co-president Sarah Schroeder said lines aren't an unusual sight, and the pantry size does not help. On days when students know the pantry has been restocked, they'll see hundreds come through in a couple of hours. "You walk down that really long hallway from the front desk, and there's times that our line is to the stairs that you walk down," Schroeder said. "So, we do see lines, especially during certain hours throughout the week. Like, we have definitely busy hours in which there will be large crowds waiting outside. Like Schroeder, leaders of food programs at the University of Iowa and University of Northern Iowa are seeing large volumes of students come through. At cost of living, and higher education continues to climb, Iowa's public universities are seeing more and more students seek out programs to help them put food on the table while juggling school, work, and other responsibilities. Resources on campus. The shop at Iowa State University offers shelf, table, and perishable foods to campus, as well as hygiene items and other necessities. Monday and Wednesday through Friday, At the University of Iowa, the food pantry at Iowa is open to anyone with a university ID Tuesday through Friday. The University of Northern Iowa's Panther Pantry offers food, hygiene, and cleaning products to students Monday through Tuesday. Each of the university's food pantries are seeing increased usage year over year, causing them to try to increase stock and limit how much can be taken if needed. In August 2022, the food pantry at Iowa saw 660 visits and gave away 6,539 pounds of food. In August of this year, it saw 990 visits and went through 1,250 pounds of food. The shop at Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa's Panther Pantry have also seen increases in students stopping by to grab items, with the shop jumping from 1,020 visits in September 2022 to 1,884 visits in September 2023, and the Panther Pantry having a 17% increase in unique students from this fall to last. Last year, University of Northern Iowa Associate Director of Student Involvement and Event Services, Connie Hasen, said the pantry saw 550 unique students. Usage of the pantry has been a steady increase since it opened in 2019. Beyond food pantries, the university also offers programs to get students access to dining halls and emergency funds. The University of Northern Iowa started a new program this fall called Panthers Against Hunger, which allows students to donate up to 20 of their dining dollars for students to get a hot meal. Iowa State University's Give a Swipe program lets students donate flex meals or dining dollars to other students in need of meal assistance. The University of Iowa's Hawkeye Meal Share program creates a pool of unused dining hall guest passes, which are distributed to students who apply. They can receive up to 14 meals through the program. Each university also has emergency funds, which students can apply for to get help meeting their expenses. Sometimes these resources aren't enough. University of Iowa Basic Needs Coordinator Steph Breacher said students who already use their pantry and meal voucher program will come to her looking for more sustainable aid, but it's just not available. We're kind of trying to scramble and find resources, and honestly, there's just times where we're like, there's nothing else we can do, Breacher said. Tracking increase needed. University of Iowa professor and researcher Catherine Bronston said long-term trend data on basic need insecurity isn't really available, but what can be tracked is rising prices of higher education and financial aid falling behind. Less state investment in higher education has promoted colleges to consistently hike tuition, and financial aid offerings have failed to fill the gap. Iowa's Regent Universities raised tuition from the third year of this spring, with in-state undergraduates paying 3.5% more and varying increases for out-of-state undergraduates. University of Northern Iowa increased tuition for in-state graduates by 3.5% as well. And Iowa State University brought it up by 4%. In the past, students were able to work their way through college, but that's not the case now. Students are dealing with higher costs of living and food, as well as education, due to inflation and wages not risking to combat it. These problems really are stemming from high price of college attendance, limited need-based financial aid that has not kept up with the rising prices of college attendance, and the wages that students are able to earn and the increased precarity of low-wage workers in our economy, Broughton said. Increased usage of food insecurity resources could also be due to higher visibility and availability of programs. The University of Iowa relocated its food pantry to a larger and more visible space in the basement of Iowa Memorial Union this August, and basic needs manager Faith Surface said the number of visitors has jumped from around 100 a week to 100 a day. I think the need has always been there, Surface said. We're just now more accessible. Finding solutions. Despite universities expanding their food access program for those in need, Broughton says resources like food pantries and meal vouchers don't actually solve the problem of food insecurity. I have a colleague who will often says that he is not able to, will not be able to food pantry our way out of this. Broughton said, food pantries are essential resources in our communities, but you know, they're not designed to end hunger. Solutions targeting how students pay for college, as well as increased access to public benefits, would have an indirect impact on food insecurities, as well as other areas of basic needs insecurity, Broughton says, as they're getting closer to long-standing root problems rather than more immediate concerns. Having plans in place to address short, moderate, and long-term issues is important, she said. As students are struggling with having food to eat and a place to stay today, but the fact that future students will experience this as well as needs to be taken into consideration. Breacher agreed, saying she's advocating for systemic change. Recalling Audre Lorde's work in the 1960s to establish community health care as they could not rely on the government for help. Beecher said that the University of Iowa needs to put more funds to the pantry and help care for its students. Students facing basic needs insecurity, with whom Broughton has worked in her research, have reported trouble focusing and feelings of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and the lack of belonging. Their attendance to class and coursework suffer while they're trying to figure out where their next meal will come from. However, food insecurity programs have been shown to help students feel better and stay on track with their schooling. A study Broughton conducted on a meal voucher program put in place by Boston Community College found that students who started college at a high-risk food insecurity were offered meal vouchers for the dining hall, had a higher attainment rate than the peers who didn't receive vouchers. She said similar studies looking at food pantries yielded similar results. Investing in basic need resources isn't just the right thing to do to help students, but it can actually improve a college's bottom line as it improves retention rates and academic success outcomes, Broughton said. Food pantry at Iowa Basic Need Manager Uniso Key said food pantries have been a lifeline for her in the past. When she was working long and odd hours trying to pay back for her schooling and life, the support she received made her want to give that back, and what made her start volunteering at the food pantry at Iowa. Anybody can walk in and need a helping hand to get through a rough patch in their life. And then they might just become inspired to follow their fellow students and community members in the same way, Key said. The next headline reads, France to ban smoking on beaches as it seeks to avoid 75,000 tobacco-related deaths per year. France will ban smoking on all beaches and public parks, forests, and some other public areas as part of a national anti-tobacco plan presented by the health minister on Tuesday. Tobacco products cause 7, 75,000 unavoidable deaths a year in France. Minister of Health and Prevention Aurélien Rousseau said on BFM television, "The government will introduce legislation at the start of next year to enlarge the scope of places where fines can be levied for smoking," he said. Beaches, parks, around schools, lots of places had started these experiments, and now it's true. We're heading to a general rule to show our determination, he said. Legislators also intend to outlaw single-use disposable e-cigarettes, with an initial vote on a draft law to ban them expected in the National Assembly next month. The next article headline reads, "Israel and Hamas extend their truce, but it seems only a matter of time before the war resumes." In Tel Aviv, Israel, a truce between Israel and Hamas entered its fifth day on Tuesday, with the militant group promising to release more civilian hostages to delay the expected resumption of war, and Israel undergoing pressure to spare Palestinian civilians when the fighting resumes. The sides agree to extend their truce through Wednesday, with another two planned exchanges of militant-held hostages for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. But Israel has repeatedly vowed to resume the war with full force to destroy Hamas once it's clear that no more hostages will be freed under the current agreement terms. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to visit this region later this week for the third time since the start of the war, and is expected to press for an extension of the truce and release more hostages. The Biden administration has told Israel it must avoid significant further displacement and mass casualties among Palestinian civilians if it resumes the offensive, and that it must operate with more precision in southern Gaza than it has in the north, according to U.S. officials. The official spoke on condition of anonymity under ground rules set by the White House. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reiterated his call for a long-term ceasefire and release of all hostages, reflecting broad international support for the cessation of hostilities. Hamas and other militants are still holding about 160 people out of the 240 seized in their October 7th assault into southern Israel that ignited the war. That's enough to potentially extend the truce for another 2 weeks under the existing framework brokered by the Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. But Hamas is expected to make much higher demands for the release of captive soldiers. Either way, Israel says it is committed to resuming the war, which is already the deadliest round of Israel-Palestinian violence in decades. It blames the soaring casualty tolls on Hamas, accusing the militants of using civilians as human shields while operating in dense residential areas. Israel has vowed to end Hamas's 16-year rule in Gaza and crush its military capabilities. That would almost certainly require expanding the ground offensive from northern Gaza, where entire residential areas have been pounded into rubble, to the south, where hundreds of thousands of displaced people have packed into overflowing United Nations shelters. Hostages released. Hamas freed another 11 women and children on Monday into the fourth and final swap planned under the initial ceasefire agreement, which went into effect Friday. Israel released 33 Palestinian prisoners. Monday's releases bring to 51 the number of Israelis freed under the truce, along with 19 hostages of other nationalities. So far, 150 Palestinians have been released from Israeli prisons. Israel said that it would extend the ceasefire by 1 day for every 10 additional hostages released. The Palestinian prisoners released so far have been mostly teenagers accused of throwing stones and firebombs during confrontations with Israeli forces. Some were convicted by Israeli courts of attempting to carry out deadly attacks. The prisoners are widely seen as Palestinians by Palestinians as heroes resisting occupation. Most of the freed hostages appeared to be physically well, but an 84-year-old woman released Sunday was hospitalized in critical condition because she had not had access to her medication in captivity. They have mostly stayed out of the public eye, but details of their captivity have started to emerge. In one of the first interviews with a freed hostage, 79-year-old Ruti Munder told Israel's Channel 13 television that she was initially fed well in captivity, but the conditions worsened as shortages took hold. She said she was kept in a suffocating room and slept on plastic chairs with a sheet for nearly 50 days. Israel imposed a total blockade of Gaza at the start of the war and had only allowed a trickle of humanitarian aid to enter prior to the ceasefire, leading to widespread shortages of food, water, medicine, and fuel to power generators amid a territory-wide power blackout. Northern Gaza in ruins. The ceasefire has allowed residents who remained in Gaza City and other parts of the north to venture out to survey the destruction and try to locate and bury relatives. Footage from northern Gaza, the focus on Israeli ground offensive, shows nearly every building damaged or destroyed. A UN-led conservatorium estimates that over 234,000 homes have been damaged across Gaza and 46,000 have been completely destroyed, amounting to around 60% of the housing stock in the territory, which is home to 2.3 million Palestinians. In the north, the destruction of homes and civilian infrastructure severely compromises the ability to meet basic requirements to sustain life, it said. More than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed since the war began, roughly two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants. More than 1,200 people have been killed on the Israeli side, mostly civilians killed in the initial attack. At least 77 soldiers have been killed in Israeli's ground force. The toll on Palestinian side is likely much higher, as the health ministry has only been able to sporadically update its count since November 11th due to the breakdown of the health sector in the north. It also says thousands of people are missing and fear trapped or death under the rubble. Israel's bombardment and ground offensive have displaced more than 1.8 million people, nearly 80% of Gaza's population, with most having sought refuge in the south, according to the UN Office of Administration Humanitarian Affairs. Israeli troops have barred people from returning to the north during ceasefire. Hundreds of thousands of people have packed into UN-run schools and other facilities, with many forced to sleep on the streets outside because of overcrowding. It's unclear where they would go if Israel expands its grounds of operation, as Egypt has refused to accept refugees and Israel has sealed its border. The UN says the truce made it possible to scale up the delivery of food, water, and medicine to the largest volume since the start of the war. But the 160 to 200 trucks a day is still less than half of what Gaza was importing before fighting, even as humanitarian needs have been soared. Juliet Toma, a spokesperson for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, said people come to shelters asking for heavy clothes, mattresses, and blankets, and that some people are sleeping in damaged vehicles. The needs are overwhelming, she told the Associated Press. They lost everything, and they need everything. Magdi reported from Cairo. Associated Press writers Amir Mahani and Zeke Miller in Washington contributed. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 28th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled in Des Moines. I'm Jessica Liu from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. In the obituaries, Barbara E. Christie, born in 1932, died in 2023. The upcoming service is on November 30th, 2023, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodling Funeral Home and Crematory. This is located at 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs, Iowa. Barbara E. Christie, age 91, of Council Bluffs, passed away on November 25th, 2023, at Hanson House Assisted Living in Council Bluffs. Barbara was born April 20th, 1932, in Omaha, the daughter of Frederick J. and Doris Buckham. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in Council Bluffs in 1950, then from St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, as a registered X-ray technician. She married Robert P. Christie on January 30, 1955, at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Council Bluffs. He passed away in 1999. Barb grew up in Council Bluffs and became a world traveler when she married Bob. They lived in Germany and England while he was in the Air Force. After his retirement, they returned to Council Bluffs. She ran her own business sewing and doing alterations, then working for the Pottawatomi County Treasurer's Office when she became Deputy County Treasurer. After retirement, her two passions were St. Paul's Episcopal Church and the Pottawatomi County Genealogical Society. When she wasn't busy at church, or PCGS, she kept her hands busy doing handcrafts, sewing, knitting, crocheting, tatting, counting cross stitch, and time with her friends. There are many other things about Barb that could be written. Her family hopes you are blessed by her memories of them. Survivors include her two children, Mary Sue White of Omaha and Rod Christine of Waterville, Kansas, five grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, and by Aunt Betty and Aunt Carol. Barb was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and infant brother, Fred Buckham Jr. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 on Thursday at Counter Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodling Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, 22 Dillam Drive in Council Bluffs. Burial will be in Memorial Park Cemetery, Council Bluffs, with a lunch following at the church. Memorials are suggested to either St. Paul's Episcopal Church or to the Pottawatomi County Genealogical Society. Charles Clifford Ludington, age 69, passed away November 25, 2023, at Fox Run in Council Bluffs. Charles was born in Council Bluffs on October 27, 1954, to the late Clifford and Joanne Ludington. Charles grew up on the family farm in Pacific Junction, Iowa, and graduated from Glenwood High School in 1973. He attended Iowa State and worked many years as a financial advisor. He and wife Marcy enjoyed their many summers at the home in Lake Okoboji. In addition to his parents, Charles is preceded in death by his wife Marcy, January 16, 2022. Charles is survived by his sons Ryan Ludington of Council Bluffs, Michael Ludington of Glenwood, stepsons Luke Martin of Lamar, Iowa, Seth Martin of Omaha, grandchildren Chloe Kellogg, Peyton and Ellie Ludington, Kylie Tanner and Hunter Martin, and other family members. Celebration of life for Charles will be Saturday, December 2nd, 2023, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Spillway Bar and Grill, 1840 Madison Avenue in Council Bluffs. Donald D. Powell passed away Saturday, November 25th, 2023, surrounded by his family. Don was born February 23rd, 1944, to C. Darnell and Rose Powell. He graduated from Underwood High School in 1962. Don served in the Army. He was a longtime resident of the Underwood Iowa area until his recent move to Council Bluffs due to health issues. He worked as a plumber for many years. His career began when Dale Lint Plumbing in Granger, Iowa. He also worked with Moss Plumbing, May Plumbing, and Borges Plumbing, all in Council Bluffs. He retired as the plumbing and mechanical inspector for the city of Council Bluffs, a position he held for almost 15 years. Don loved sports. He attended as many baseball, softball, basketball, and track events he could for his children and grandchildren, traveling out of town if necessary to watch them play. Don was a quiet spectator but shouting on the inside. Don married Dina Sparcello on October 9, 1971. He is preceded in death by his parents, sister Jane, and brothers Charles and Richard. He is survived by his wife of 52 years, son Jared, daughter and son-in-law Sarah and Rob Dressel. He is also survived by grandsons Jake and Riley Powell and Caleb Dressel, nieces and nephews, and many friends including Jerry and Vicky Maguire, and longtime best friend Larry Kerr. Visitation with the family on Saturday from 9:30 to 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodling Furniture Home. Internment in Ridgewood Cemetery with military honors by American Legion Post No. 2. Luncheon will follow. Lori L. Salisbury, age 55, of Underwood, Iowa, passed away suddenly November 21, 2023, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Lori was born September 13, 1968, in Waterloo, Iowa, to Richard and Maylin Dean. She graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1986 and attended Ozark Community College and University of Iowa. Lori proudly served her community in the Army National Guard and was deployed during Operation Desert Storm. She married Ronald D. Salisbury on March 12, 1994. Lori was a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service for the past 30 years, 20 years as a rural carrier in Glenwood, Iowa. She was member of the VFW Post number 11355. She is survived by her husband of 29 years, Ron Salisbury of Underwood, sons Ray Salisbury of Council Bluffs, Rhett Salisbury of Minden, Iowa, 12 grandchildren, stepsons Jesse Albin of Waterloo, Iowa, Roman Albin of Owenny, Iowa, parents Richard and Maylin Dean of Dyke, Iowa, brother Rick Dean of Parkersburg, Iowa, sisters Wendy Dean of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Julie Dean of St. Mary's, Iowa, other family members, and many friends. Celebration of Life Visitation Saturday, December 2nd, 2023, from 3 to 5 at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodling Bayless Park Chapel and Council Bluffs. Military honors and flag presentation will begin at 3 p.m. by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Memorial contributions are suggested to any humane society of the donor's choice. Gertrude Suzanne Smith, 90, of Omaha, passed away November 24, 2023. Born July 19, 1933, in Neal, Iowa, to Ida Grace Welch and Donald Welch. Susie was the fifth of 10 children. She grew up in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and graduated from St. Francis High School. Susie spent her career at the phone company. Susie was kind and loving to all people, but especially loved children. She was beloved by all who knew her. Susie is survived by her five children, Pauline Quinn, Bruce Smith, Deborah Smith, Pamela Edmonds, and Rodney Smith, and one of her brothers, Jim Welch, and one of her sisters, Helene Blankley, who has 11 grandchildren and 19 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by daughters-in-law Nancy Smith and Terry Smith, along with 7 brothers and sisters. A rosary and mass will be held at Mary Our Queen Church in Omaha, Nebraska, on Thursday, November 30th, starting at 10:30 a.m. Memorials to be sent to Mary our Queen, 3405 South 118th Street, Omaha, Nebraska 68144, or the Alzheimer's Association, 225 North Michigan Avenue, GL 17, Chicago, Illinois 60601. Donald Lee Van Stolen, age 84, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 24, 2023, in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Don was born February 11, 1939, in Soley, Iowa, to the late Cornelius and Durkee Van Stolen. He graduated from Iowa School for the Deaf in 1858. Don married Patricia Carolett on April 3, 1960. They were blessed with five children, Pamela, Paula, David, Peg, and Thomas. Don worked at Lucid Technologies for 30 years, retiring in 1999. He attended Bettelman Deaf Lutheran Church and was a member of the CB Silent Club, Iowa Association of the Deaf, and the Omaha Deaf Senior Center. In addition to his parents, Don was preceded in death by his son-in-law, Al Steuben, brothers Peter, Ralph, Henry, and Clarence, sisters Dorothy, Armica, Cornelia, Arkema, Christina, Hopin, and Mary Brandoff. Don is survived by his wife of 63 years, Patricia Van Solen of the Council Bluffs, five children, Pamela Parsons of Parisia, Iowa, Paula Stephen, David Van Solen, both of Logan, Iowa, Peg Moore, Thomas Van Solen, all of Council Bluffs, 15 grandchildren, five great-grandchildren, Sister Joanne Sorodima of Denver, Colorado, sisters-in-law Bernice Van Solen of Newton, Iowa, Millie Van Solen of Toledo, Iowa, nieces, nephews, and many friends. Visitation with the family, Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer, Woodling Basis Park Chapel. Funeral service, Thursday, 10:30 a.m. at Community of Christ Church, 140 West Canesville Boulevard. A lunch will immediately follow the service at the church. Interment Thursday at 2:30 p.m. in the Little Sioux, Iowa Cemetery. Memorial are suggested to Community of Christ Church, Omaha Deaf Senior Center, or the Iowa Association of the Deaf. In the sports section, headlines read, Hawkeyes, Freeman off to strong start for Iowa. Following a Thanksgiving split in San Diego, Iowa has just one game this week before Big Ten play begins with a bang December 4th at number 1 Purdue. The Hawkeyes are 4-2 ahead of Wednesday's 8 p.m. home tilt against North Florida, 4-3. Iowa lost to undefeated and 25th-ranked Oklahoma, 6-0, before beating Seton Hall, 4-2, at the Randy Children's Invitational. Head coach Fran McCaffrey was pleased with his team's performance. I think it was good for us. We played two really good teams, two very well-coached teams that challenge us in different ways. Obviously, we have more of that coming as you look at our schedule, McCaffrey said. It's just an opportunity for, in particular, the young guys to get playing time against teams of that caliber in a different setting. We have obviously a tough team coming in here Wednesday, and then two difficult road games after that. Marlene High School grad Owen Freeman's fast start to his career has fans clamoring for more. The 6'10 freshman is averaging 9.3 points per game in just 14 minutes of action. Freeman is making nearly 60% of his shots so far. Freeman, who committed to Iowa as a junior in high school, has twice been named the Big Ten Freshman of the Week. Starting next week, he'll be playing against several of the schools that were hot on his trail as a prep standout. He was being very heavily recruited as a young player, which isn't uncommon for guys as big as he is. But his athleticism and his talent was obvious, so we knew we would be battling a lot of Big Ten schools and other regional schools, Notre Dame places like that. He was offered by everybody like that, McCaffrey recalled. He was very thorough and didn't want the process to continue on, so he committed pretty early, so we were thrilled by that. Freeman has come off the bench in all six games so far. To date, McCaffrey has used the same five starters: Ben Kirk, Peyton Stanford, Tony Perkins, Patrick McCaffrey, and DeSante Bowen. The head coach indicated they're likely to continue with that five, but isn't ruling anything out. Everybody wants to start. I think we have a unique roster in the sense that we're deeper probably than we've been. So those guys are going to, whether they start or not, they know they're going to play, McCaffrey said. They might end up playing more than the starters depending upon how the game goes. It's not like, okay, we have five starters, we have two or three subs, and those guys know what their roles are, and they play that role. Sometimes you have to go bigger. Sometimes guys get in foul trouble. Sometimes a guy has a sprained ankle, so somebody else gets to play more. That's kind of the team we have now. In the life and entertainment section, Hunger Games feasts, Napoleon conquers, but Wish doesn't come true at Thanksgiving box office. In New York, the Walt Disney Company's Wish had been expected to rule the Thanksgiving weekend box office, but moviegoers instead feasted on leftovers, as Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, led ticket sales for the second weekend, according to studio estimates Sunday. Neither of the weekend's top new releases, Wish and Ridley Scott's Napoleon, could keep up with Lionsgate's Hunger Games prequel. After debuting the previous weekend with $44.6 million, The Return of Panem proved the top drawer for holiday moviegoers, grossing $28.8 million over the weekend and $42 million over the five-day holiday frame. In 2 weeks of release, Songbirds and Snakes has grossed nearly $100 million domestically and $200 million globally. The closer contest was for second place, where Napoleon narrowly outmaneuvered Wish. Scott's epic performance expectations to take $32.5 million over the next five-day weekend and an estimated $20.4 million Friday through Sunday. The film, starring Joaquin Phoenix as the French emperor and Vanessa Kirby as his wife, Josephine de Bourhances, was also the top movie globally with $78.8 million. Reviewers were mixed, 61% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, and ticket buyers were nonplussed, a B-minus cinema score. But Napoleon fared far better in theaters than its subjects did at Waterloo. Napoleon, like Martin Scorsese's Killer of the Flower Moon, is a big budget statement by Apple Studios of the streamer's swelling Hollywood ambitions. With an estimated budget of $200 million, Napoleon may still have a long road to reach profitably for Apple, which partnered with Sony to distribute Napoleon theatrically. But it's undeniably strong beginning for an adult-skewing 168-minute historical drama. Wish, however, had been supposed to have more starry-eyed start. Disney Animation released Like Frozen 2, which made $123.7 million over 5 days in 2019. Ralph Breaks the Internet, $84.6 million in 2019. And Coco, $71 million in 2017, have often owned Thanksgiving movie going. But Wish wobbled, coming in with $3.1 million over 5 days and $19.5 million Friday through Sunday. It added 17.3 million internationally. It had been forecast to debut closer to 50 million. Wish, at least, is faring better than Disney's Thanksgiving release last year. 2022's Strange World bombed with a 5-day 18.9 million openings. But hopes were higher for Wish. Co-written and co-directed by the Frozen team of Chris Bunk and Jennifer Lee, and featured the voices of Ariana DeBose and Chris Pine. Wish, a fairy tale centered around a wish upon star, is also a celebration of Disney itself, timed to the studio's 100th anniversary and rife with callbacks to Disney's favorites. Critics weren't impressed, saying Wish felt more like marketing than movie magic. So instead of writing an up and down year for Disney, Wish is for now adding to some of the studio's recent headaches, including the underperforming The Marvels. The Marvel sequel has limped to 76.9 million domestically and $110.2 million overseas in 3 weeks. Wish also faced direct competition for families in Trolls Band Together. The DreamWorks and Universal Pictures release opened a week prior and took in $17.5 million in its second frame, $25.3 million in over 5 days. Wishes ran into much more competitive market than what Disney might normally see in the Thanksgiving corridor, said Paul Dergarbiandian, senior media analyst for data firm Comstore. We're accustomed to seeing those Disney films at the top of the chart. They kind of had to split the audience with Trolls. Still, the head story isn't written yet on Wish. It could follow the lead of Pixar's Elemental, which launched with a lukewarm 29.6 million in June, but found its leg ultimately grossing nearly $500 million worldwide. Also entering wide released over the holiday weekend was Emerald Fennell's Saltburn, the writer-director follow-up to 2020 Promising Young Woman. After debuting in 7 packed theaters last weekend, Saltburn grossed $3.1 million over 5 days for Amazon and MGM. Barry Cogan stars as an Oxford student befriended by a rich classmate, Jacob Elordi, and invited to his family's country manor. As Hollywood's awards season accelerates, Focus Features The Holdovers continues to be one of the top choices in cinema. Alexander Payne's film starring Paul Giamatti as the boarding school instructor made $3.8 million over the 5-day weekend. In 5 weeks, it grossed $12.9 million. Ticket sales overall reached $172 million in the U.S. and Canada theaters over 5-day holiday weekend, according to Comscore. That's up significantly from recent years, but well behind the typical pre-pandemic Thanksgiving weekends. In 2019, sales boosted up by Frozen 2 surpassed $262 million. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 28, 2023. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Jessica Liu from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.